Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight was one of 12 children that grew up on a farm in rural Indiana and got a job in 1964 at Ford Motor Company's Louisville, Kentucky assembly plant as a chassis line repairman. He joined the UAW's Local Union 862 and rose through its ranks to become the UAW's chief president in 2002. On June 30th, 2010, he'll step down from this position. His name, Ron Gettelfinger. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on
News Talk WJR 760 AM.
Amen.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the president of the United Auto Workers Association, Ron Gettelfinger. Ron, welcome, an honor to have you.
Well, thank you, Jack, and thank you very much for having the UAW on your program.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, my father's still living, by the way. Celebrated his 95th birthday on October the 11th of last year. And he's in very good health, and we're very, very pleased and blessed to still have him with us. Just a delight. Hard-working man. He did. He raised a large family and went from job to job like many people, because even though at that time there were, you know, the country was doing fairly well, there was still a lot of ups and downs in the economy from various times. But good union man. And I guess that's where I got some of my union background. And my mother, just a wonderful woman, and she's deceased, but she raised a good family and just a very good American and a caring mother.
12 children. Where did you fall, Ron?
Well, down the stack somewhere there. Number five. Yeah, number five. Number five on the list, a good spot to be because, you know, in a family that large, the oldest normally is gone from home by the time the youngest gets into school. And but there wasn't a lot of a difference in our ages. But even at that, you know, you had what we referred to when we were growing up as the big kids and the little kids. I fell in the big kids group, but I wasn't at the top of that. So by being number five, I kind of had that connection on both ends.
You grew up on a farm in rural Indiana. Talk to us about life on a farm 60 years ago.
Well, it's no different than what most people do that live in the country. I mean, it wasn't a way to make a living. It was a way to survive, if you will, because with that many kids, no matter what kind of a job my dad would have had, he needed to be able to supplement his income. And a little farm that we had was a good way of doing that. It was a little over 100 acres. And, you know, like most people we had in that area, we had, you know, had our own beef and raised hogs and had chickens and those kind of things. So, you know, that provides you a pretty good meal. We never went hungry because of a lack of food. And it was because of the farm.
What did growing up on a farm teach Ron Gettelfinger about leading the women and the men of the UAW?
Well, you know, you go into leadership issue, and it's much more than growing up on a farm, I think. But by the same token, being in a large family, whether we believed it or not at the time, you do develop. And there was opportunities to be the big brother, if you will, and also to be the little brother. And, you know, the smaller children in the family would look up to you. So I guess in a way that was leadership. But, you know, there was a lot of discipline involved in a family that size. There was a lot of chores for everybody to do. And we learned that all of us working together, we could make things happen. Whether it was milking the cows in the morning and the evening, or whether it was picking pickles, which we raised an acre of pickles. And by the way, that's an interesting story in and all of itself. But we had chores to do. And I guess in many ways, leadership did come out of that.
How was it you went to work for Ford Motor Company in its Louisville, Kentucky assembly plant.
You know, I had a job. Actually, I was a bulk feed truck driver. And I drove by the Ford plant there one day and thought, man, wouldn't it be good if you could get a job there? And at that time, in our area, Ford, DuPont, General Electric, Standard Gravera, companies like that, Brown & Williamson, National Distilleries, they were all pretty much, you could come out of high school and you could go in and get a job. And so I went into the military, but then when I came back, I was looking for a job, and I applied for Ford and got hired. And I was very appreciative of that. I was appreciative both to Ford Motor Company and to the UAW because it did. It provided a very good standard of living.
What does a chassis line repairman do?
Well, that is a term that we use in the plants. We don't use that term so much anymore because over the years we've learned that, you know, it's better to build them right on the line as opposed to try to build them right at the end of the line. And really, chassis line repairman was, I was on the line, and if there was something that went wrong, you immediately stepped in and took care of it, made sure it was right. But again, that term's pretty much outdated now, but it's something I like to be known as because that's what I was, and that's what I am today. I'm a chassis line repairman.
And a very good one.
Well, I don't know about that. Jack, I'm just a chassis line repairman and proud to have the UAW union card in my wallet and proud to have union in my heart.
We're talking to Ron Gettelfinger. When we come back, we'll ask him how it was he got actively involved in the union. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on
News Talk, WJR 760 AM.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Ron Gettelfinger. And arguably, he's had as tough a job the last three and a half years as anybody in America. And he's done a phenomenal job with it. Ron, a lot of people went to work for Ford, became union members, but they didn't get actively involved. How was it you got actively involved?
I guess part of the reason, Jack, is I was extremely appreciative of the job. Coming out of a large family and us struggling every day to make ends meet in many instances. And then to get a job that I had left, a job that I was able to make more in a couple of days than I was making on the job that I had before. I was just appreciative of it. And so you say, how did you get involved in a union? Actually, I started going to union meetings right away. Now, a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people didn't do it. And then I got myself involved on some committees. And then open elections. We're a very democratic union. Every 3 years, we held elections. And I went to summer school, which is training within our union in the early, very early, well, 1970, in fact. And it was then that I made up my mind, hey, I'm out here campaigning for people to get elected to being a union official. Seems to me like maybe I should put my name in the hat. And I did, and I was very successful in the sense that I did get elected, and that started it all. But it was really, it's just a wonderful job to have the opportunity to walk up and down the assembly lines, to talk to workers, to hear what their complaints are, and then to work with the management to fix problems. It's just something I love to do.
Tell us about the history of the UAW.
Well, you know, by the way, speaking of the history of the UAW, this is the 75th anniversary of the UAW on August the 26th of this year. In addition to that, it's the 50th anniversary of the Library of Labor and Urban Affairs at Wayne State University and the 35th anniversary of the Walter Philip Reuther Library, which is also located on Wayne State University. Houses the best collection of labor archives anywhere in the world. And Mike Smith directs the Reuther down there. So there's where the history of the UAW is actually housed. But, you know, the UAW's had the first president was named Francis Dillon. Francis Dillon was appointed by the AFL because that's when the UAW was chartered, right here at the Fort Shelby Hotel in the city of Detroit. And then following Francis Dillon, we had Homer Martin and R.J. Thomas. Most people think that Walter Reuther was the first president of the UAW. He was the fourth president and tragically killed in a plane crash on May the 9th of 1970. And then following him was Leonard Woodcock. And each president up to that point in time had handled their own challenges. And I say that because if you go back to Francis Dillon, it was the formation of the UAW. Homer Martin, R.J. Thomas, growth periods. Walter Reuther, tremendous growth, very innovative negotiator. Came up with some great settlements with the auto companies that really set the standard for the rest of the nation. UAW was very, very powerful then with a million and a half members. And so then the recognition that the UAW got was with, if you look at Leonard Woodcock, after he served his term, he was an ambassador to China. Following Leonard Woodcock, of course, was Douglas Fraser. And Doug was probably the most beloved president of the UAW. And he held office during the time of the early 70s there when we had the Chrysler loan guarantees, if you'll recall at that time. And his relationship with President Jimmy Carter and then with Lee Iacocca was just really instrumental in bringing that about. Then you go from Doug to Owen Bieber. And Owen, again, faced a different set of challenges. And he was really just a great president as well. And then came Stephen P. Jokic. And Steve had the presidency during the growth time in the economy, if you will. Not so much in our union, because at that point in time, the auto companies were already scaling back dramatically, and they had been for a number of years. So the membership was on a decline, and then when we took it over, it seems like the last 7.5 years have been pretty interesting. We've always had something going on, dealing with the bankruptcies, auto negotiations, and etc. But the history of the UAW is built around that. And, you know, we believe this, that workers should have a voice. And the only way that you're going to have any form of equity and justice in the workplace is by having a union.
Tell us about the 1.1 million women and men of the UAW that you, Ron Gettelfinger, serve.
Well, the majority of those are retirees now, and under the big three, and then a few other companies, as an example, Navistar, Dana, and others, we have their health care in a voluntary employee beneficiary association. But we are very active with our retired workers. And we, under the direction of Linda Lash, who is our community services and retired workers director, we keep in touch with our retirees. We're there to help them if they need assistance. We continue to keep them on our mailing list. We send them our monthly magazine. We do those things because we recognize the value of our retirees, and we're very supportive of them. Our active membership is down below 400,000. We'll report around 355,000 or so. It's actually a little higher than that, but that's the way that our per capita is paid in, but when we do our government reporting forms at the end of the year. But, you know, we're just out there. If there's workers out there, we represent them. Most people think of the UAW as a UAW. They don't think of the state employees. They don't think of casino workers. They don't think about road deputies and jailers. So cooks, and if you name it, we like to think of ourselves as a union of all workers. In fact, we represent more graduate student employees than any other union in the country.
Ron Gettelfinger, you're the fifth of 12 kids, rural farm, Indiana. And you become the president of the UAW. In God's master plan, that was the way it was. How did that ever happen? Anything is possible.
But Jack, if you look at yourself and your career and where you've ended up, if you would have went back years ago and looked at that, you'd never dreamed it. And I'm no different than anybody else. You know, I ran through some very tough elections in the local. And because, you know, when you're in a leadership position and people have the opportunity to vote for you, sometimes everybody doesn't agree and don't think you're the best thing since sliced bread. But, I mean, you know, that's just perhaps it was God's master plan. That's the only thing I can say. I can't account for it. I'm very privileged, blessed, and honored to serve the men and women of the UAW in this capacity.
If there's a young listener tonight that's got a huge dream, what do you say to him or her?
Well, what I would say to anybody is, you know, there's a lot of hope. We hear a lot of negativity out here. And, you know, one of the things that I think from a personal standpoint that's hurt our country is this 24-hour spin meisters that are out there on TV and, you know, filling up the airwaves, and they're just constantly hammering the negativity, if you will. And, you know, I just try to set that stuff aside. And what I would say to young people is, you know, first of all, you got to believe in yourself. And then you got to have hope. And, you know, you got to believe you can make a difference. One of my favorite sayings is Bobby Kennedy said, if you but move a pebble of sand on the beach, you've changed the world. Now, that is an optimistic attitude, but it's true. And we all can, by hard work, dedication, believing in ourselves, we can live the American dream. It's just that our economy's on a downturn right now, but things are starting to pick up. We see it in the auto industry. We see it in the supply base. We see it coming. So young people can get involved out there and make a difference. And look, I believe this. I'm a UAW member. I serve the people below me, and that's the way I believe. Some others may look at it differently, but to me, it's important to know that regardless of what you do, you ask me about going to union meetings, well, what about going to PTA and the PTO? What about attending community, like in my case, monthly Democrat meetings? Whatever it is, I want to make a difference. I am not going to sit by and just be in a community and not give back. And I think we can do that. But there's hope for people, and there's a lot of opportunity out there, Jack.
I think the Irish have a saying, there's so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us that it ill behooves any of us to criticize the rest of us.
Well, yes, you're right. And that's excellent, because I fall in those two categories. Now, I wish I wasn't as critical sometimes, but I do fall in those two categories you described about the good and the bad.
And we're with Ron Gettelfinger, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on
News Talk WJR 760 AM.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Now, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
We're talking to Ron Gettelfinger, who will retire from his position as president in June 30th of this year. And I have to say, in 5 years of doing this show, something just happened for the first time. A guest asked for a coffee break, and that's never happened before. This is truly union mentality.
So. Well, come on, Jack. I needed coffee. You know, we've been doing the March of Dimes PSAs, and we've been here quite a while, but we're working with our coffee. Because, you know, you did touch on a great point there, and, you know, there's a lot of misconception about unions. There really is. I would just challenge anybody to go into an assembly plant today, go on an assembly line, and tell me about the workers there. Safety, quality, productivity, hardworking, caring about the customer. So, but I am entitled to a sip of coffee.
Okay.
And I promise not to interrupt you.
It's cappuccino. It's cappuccino,
no,
too. So.
Well, it's it looks to me like it's regular coffee.
Okay. Speaking of which, can you share with us, Ron, some of the major concessions the UAW has made to the Big Three in these last 3 years?
Well,
this is only an hour show.
Right. Well, look, first of all, we care about survival of these companies and anywhere where we represent workers. We are very much care about the success of the employer, whoever it may be. And we did the responsible thing. And if you go back to 2003, we made some minor adjustments to our contract. One example would be we have a cost of living allowance, and we took the line item off of the computation of that for health care. But we did other things. We've took bonuses. 05 mid-contract. In the case of General Motors, we took $18 billion of other post-employee benefits off of their books, which amounted to $3 billion in annualized expenses and $1 billion in cash. And then we move forward mid-contract 05, which is what we really did with Ford as well. We didn't do anything at Chrysler. But then following the 05, we got into negotiations at the local union levels across the country. And then in 07, we took all of the other post-employee benefits off of the company's books, which just went into effect on January the 1st of this year. So we now have a voluntary employee beneficiary association set up to take care of our retirees, and it's controlled by independent trustees. Then we followed the 07 negotiations. Now, I would want to point this out. When we went into 07 negotiations, General Motors stock was around $20 a share. That was hailed as a transformational agreement. General Motors stock was over $42 a share when we came out of those negotiations. The men and women of the UAW received a lot of recognition and awards, actually, for what they did in 07. It's 08 that we started getting into trouble, but we made additional concessions in 08. You heard about the infamous Jobs Bank, which was honestly, we honored the agreement. The Jobs Bank was actually set up so that the company could take product out that they weren't competitive on and bring work in that they were. Now, we allowed them to take the work out. The problem was they didn't bring work back in, and that created the bank. But we did away with that. And then, of course, in 09, we went through a lot in Washington. We did away with COLA. We did away with all increases. So basically, nobody at Ford and General Motors will get or have the opportunity for any form of wage increase from 2005, actually 2006, through negotiations in 2011. So there's been a lot of major changes. We were at the bargaining table six times with the big three in 2009. First here locally, and then with the government. So, you know, it's been a challenging time for the men and women of the UAW, but they have stepped up to the plate time and time again. Probably the most disturbing thing about it was, and I used to say this all the time, we're on third base, and none of the other stakeholders in the process had even been in the ballpark yet. And we continued to get hammered and hammered. But we came out of it well. We did the very best we could for our membership.
You and your team convinced the membership that they had to make these major concessions one after another after another. How did you do that?
I think the membership is responsible. And they know what we were going through at the time. And if you go back again to the Chrysler loan guarantees, the men and women at Chrysler made tremendous sacrifice. It's just that it's been like a barrage of sacrifices that we've had to face. And as you know, the last attempt at Ford failed overwhelmingly to make additional changes. So we were successful in the sense that people knew, look, General Motors and Chrysler were in bankruptcy. So what do? You try to fight for survival. And we're very pleased with the way these companies are positioned today. But we've got a responsible membership. It's just a matter of making sure that they're informed when they cast their vote on what's going on.
We had John Ricardo on a few years ago, who was a great man for Chrysler, too. The animosity, the vitriolic language today on both sides is awful. I've admired you and been amazed at the people on the other side, your opponents, regularly respect you and like you, even though you have the differences. How have you done that, Ron?
Well, You know, I think one of the greatest compliments that I was ever paid by, and at the time it was a superintendent in the plant where I, my home plant, the Louisville Assembly Plant. I got to say Louisville Assembly Plant. I can't say it the northern way here. But the Louisville Assembly Plant, superintendent was leaving, and he came up and he said, "You know what, Ron?" He said, "You're firm, but you're fair. And you see, if you take me into any represented workplace and you show me a strong and fair supervisor and a strong and fair committee person, I'll show you a department that runs like a clock." Because actually, management's insulated in many cases. People don't think about it that way, but they are. And they are surrounded by people that tell them oftentimes what they want to hear. Jack Nassar said to me, he said, "You know, Ron, I really appreciate it. I may not agree with what you tell me, but you bring it to me unfiltered. You believe it's the truth, but it's unfiltered. And oftentimes I don't get unfiltered feedback." So I think that's part of the role. But look, I treat people like I want to be treated. And my job, our jobs as union representatives, the executive board, our international reps, the local union committee people, it's to represent the people. And that is going to be odds at times. But by the same token, we try to do it in a fair and just manner.
A couple years ago, Wall Street Journal wrote an article and said, "You said the dumbest thing of the year when you said Ford Motor Company's got a great future." You were a great fortune teller on that. Talk to us about why Ford has come back, and talk to us about Ellen Mullally, who recently you and he were named the co-chair of this year's March of Dimes.
Yeah. Obviously, well, let me back up on Ellen Mullally just a minute and tell you that in the spring of 2006, Bill Ford had called me and suggested that he had his CFO at the time was Don LeClair, and that they were going to explore borrowing some money because of the low interest rates, that he thought it was the right thing to do. He didn't want us to be alarmed if we heard it. In fact, he used the term "hawk the blue oval." In September of 2006, they were in the process of trying to finalize this transaction, and then Ellen Mullally came on the scene, and I think that probably assisted in helping them to finalize the transaction to get the money, $18 billion, I believe it was, what they had borrowed. Then when Ellen came in, I knew Ellen from Boeing, because when I was a vice president of the UAW, I also had responsibility in addition to Ford to our aerospace, which took in Boeing. So I knew him. And when Bill Ford had called me in August to tell me that he had recruited him, he was sort of surprised that I knew Ellen. But look, Ellen is a visionary in the sense that he knows one thing. You got to keep focused. One of the problems we've had with our industry here in this community is we haven't been able to deal with success. I think the thing that makes him different is he came in under very difficult times. There was a lot of speculation about Ford when Ellen got there. In fact, I'm the one that makes the recommendation to our executive board which company we go to first in national negotiations. And in 2007, the one we went to last was Ford, because Ford was in the worst shape. So the one Ford theme that Ellen has put out there has been very good for the company. They've got great product coming out. You've seen their quality ratings now for years. They've got wonderful vehicles out there on the road. So it's just come together for them. And I like to say they're hitting on all cylinders right now. And honestly, to me, Bill Ford is just a great executive. When he initiated the loans, when he was willing to stand up and say, "I don't need this position. I need to be the chairman of the board." And that took a lot of courage and a lot of guts, and you never heard many people say that. But that was recognition that he needed somebody else to help him run that company. And that means no ego involved. I just can't do the job. That's the bottom line. But I have an absolute utmost respect for him, and I think that when he selected Ellen to come in, he did a wonderful job. Going to the March of Dimes, I'm really pleased to be with Ellen. Dr. Jennifer Howes asked Ellen and I if we would be the national co-chairs for the March of Dimes. And so we're very, very pleased to assume that role. We had the kickoff, if you will, in Washington, D.C. at the Library of Congress in October of last year, I believe it was. And, you know, for us to have a challenge out there of helping to raise, helping the March of Dimes to give babies a healthy start in life by raising $100 million. It's just fun to, it's fun to be a part of it. Now, we've always supported the March of Dimes, but it's just at this outreach with having Alan there, Ed Whitaker from General Motors, Sergio Marchione from Chrysler, and the supply base. And then we want everybody involved. We want young people involved. We want government involved. We want everybody involved to have the opportunity to help babies.
And they will be honoring our own Mike and Susie Feezy this year, which is fabulous and well-deserved. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
That's my role.